Hello and welcome to Playback.
European Union, they're very tough, very, very tough traders. You know, you think of European Union, very friendly. They rip us off. It's so sad to see. It's so pathetic. 39%, we're going to charge them 20%. So we're charging them essentially half.
U.S. President Donald Trump's press conference from the Rose Garden of the White House on Wednesday night set the news agenda for the rest of the week on the airwaves. Taoiseach Sir Simon Harris came into studio to give his reaction to Claire Byrne the following morning.
I'm just really interested to hear about your phone call with the US Commerce Secretary, Howard Lutnick. You said that there was an exchange of views. That was the official line that came out of that meeting. What was he like on that call? Because he reckons we're operating a scam here.
He certainly didn't use any of that language in the call with me. He was engaging. He was willing to talk things through. He certainly said to me on that call, and I want to be respectful of the call, but he certainly said to me that the sequencing was likely to be that President Trump was determined to bring about the, let's call them the EU-wide tariffs, that what we saw last night, effectively, but that also the President did wish to take action on five specific sectors, on steel and aluminium, where he's already taken action, on cars, where he's taken action, but also on semiconductors, on lumber, and on pharma. And I made the point to the Secretary that, well, to two things, really. One, I asked him, would there be time for proper substantive discussion between the European Union and the United States on the issue of pharma, because I believe it's much more complex than is first alluded to. And then secondly, I made the point that a lot of what we produce in companies based in Ireland aren't actually finished products. They're commodities that go back into US factories. I think about 80%, Claire, and that actually there's added value made in US factories. And we agreed to keep in touch. But he did tell me, in fairness to him, he did tell me that it was likely that there would be a lag time, for want of a better phrase, between the general announcement yesterday and some sector specific announcements.
Okay.
And I now intend to use that time at an EU level on the issue of pharma.
That's really important for us to know, because people were relieved when they heard that pharma wasn't on the list. But you're in no doubt, having had that conversation with Howard Lutnick, that measures are coming.
Oh, I believe in being very honest and very upfront with people in relation to this. President Trump is very clear of the five sectors that he wants to take measures in, and pharma is one of those five sectors.
Former European Commissioner and Fine Gael MEP Mairead McGuinness was on Morning Ireland, where she spoke to Áine Lawler.
The key message I would have, if I were still around the table at the Commission, is this is a time for Europe to build on its strengths, not to feel that it is vulnerable, and actually to do things, to act like do the Savings and Investment Union, mobilise the money that is on deposits in our banks to invest in our future. There are other markets that we can look to. Look to Ireland's pharmaceutical industry. Look to our food industry. We are world leaders. The United States citizen, we don't impose or push our products on them. They demand them. They like them. They buy them. That's why we have such trade there, because we have high value quality goods. Others will want those as well. I hope we can get back to a place where the US citizen can continue to enjoy beautiful butter on their bread, and it is Kerrygold. And I think that that's our objective, that this is a really difficult time, but we need to look at the medium and long term. But we really do need in the European Union, and this is going to be a challenge for member states, and indeed the Commission has to lead on this, to fix those things we've been neglecting, fix our competitiveness, to roll out the bureaucracy that's unnecessary, to get the investment flowing, to get banking union in place. And now is the moment. And now is a sense of not panic, but certainly some urgency.
And later in the day, against a backdrop of tumbling share prices, Cormac O'Hara spoke to Molly Ball, senior political correspondent with The Wall Street Journal, to get a sense of how Trump's tariffs were going down in the US.
The business community here, both in the United States and globally, really did not think that Trump would go quite this far. And he has really gone big on the tariffs with that announcement yesterday. And so I think the reaction is one of shock and a little bit of distress at the potential for this to intentionally reshape the global and the domestic economy. And it could potentially, experts are saying, thrust the economy into a recession.
But he posted on social media, Molly, that the operation is over, as I say, but he went on to say the patient lived and is healing. The prognosis is that the patient will be far stronger
bigger, better and more resilient than ever before, a lot of that in caps.
That's right. That has always been the belief of Donald Trump and his allies, that by changing the structure of the global economy and America's relationship to it, you would in the long run have a stronger economy, that there would be more manufacturing here in America, a more self-sufficient country, one in which more people are employed in manufacturing and the production of goods that people can buy here at home. Of course, the short-term potential is for prices to go way up and many people to lose jobs. So that is the concern in the short term. But Trump has this vision that in the long term, things will be better in the end.
Yeah, I wonder, will it though? Because the European Union, they're saying they're going to take stock and then they will react. China is saying they'll have countermeasures at the ready quite soon. And then, as you say, prices are going to tick upwards now for US consumers. And because markets are going down, surely they'll be wondering about their 401ks, the pension plans.
That's right. There's the potential for this to cause economic pain and some political distress. Trump, you know, cannot run for re-election again. He is politically not himself in danger. We are already seeing a backlash brewing, a groundswell of enthusiasm for the opposition, for the Democratic Party here in America. So there is quite a bit of concern among rank-and-file Republicans that this could hurt their party's prospects.
Is there any clarity, Molly, on how the calculation came about? And also the mistakes, which are quite apparent, and people are chuckling at how the Heard Island and McDonald Islands, which are unpopulated, they were also tariffed.
That's right. Those penguins are going to really have to pay for the unfairness that they've inflicted on the American public through unfair trade. These numbers, these very high percentages for a lot of countries, appear to have been calculated, according to the White House, based not only on tariffs and other trade barriers, but based on trade imbalances. Trump has long felt that any kind of trade deficit, any kind of trade imbalance reflects a fundamental unfairness.
The question of how exactly President Trump arrived at the tariff figures he claimed the US was being charged also came up during another conversation on Drive Time with economist David McWilliams.
If a student in my class in Trinity gave me that formula in the exam to express the assumed level of a country's protection, I'd fail them. But I'll tell you what it is, OK?
Yeah.
It is the trade surplus that a country runs with America divided by the exports that country has to America. It is a very basic formula. I don't know how they've managed, but I mean, America is the country with more Nobel Prize winners for economics than any other. And they are using ordinary level leaving cert economics to base their trade policy on. So 39 isn't some sort of, oh, it's a bit of chickeny stuff and we'll add a little bit of non-tariff. It's a formula. But we should just say in Ireland, I'll just give you one last thing. Had this formula been applied to us uniquely and not as a member of the EU, the figure would have come at 68% and the tariffs facing Ireland exclusively would have been 35%. So we can thank our lucky stars that we were thrown in with the EU, because there was a fear, Cormac, that we would have been isolated on our own. Do you remember there was an idea of the Dirty 15, which were the 15 countries with the biggest trade surpluses? Unfortunately, the Asian countries, the Vietnams of this world, were treated uniquely.
And they suffered.
Cormac also asked David, what should Ireland do now?
I think we're dealing with the most mercurial, narcissistic, unpredictable man. Okay? And when I say man, it is the man running the tariffs. Like, Donald Trump has been anti-trade deficits from the 80s. People can go back and Google and see him, right? He has now got economists who will actually come up with formulas to articulate some sort of coherent strategy. Who knows what he'll be thinking on Sunday or on Monday or on Tuesday? We saw what happened with the Canadians. It was on, it was off, etc. I think the EU, sit in your hands, make it very aware that we could retaliate and might retaliate, but just allow a little bit of calm and peace to reign rather than up the ante with somebody who we know likes a scrap. I mean, Trump loves a scrap. He sees the world, winners and losers and territory and all that sort of stuff. I would say do nothing for the moment. Let's see how these things pan out. See how the Chinese react. See how the Asians react, because they will react quicker because they have been actually treated much, much worse than we have been.
To get a different perspective on Trump's approach to tariffs, also on the same programme, Sarah McInerney spoke to Greg Swenson of Republicans Overseas UK.
Yeah, it's not tariffs. It's tariffs plus the other barriers. Like, for example, here in the UK, much of the American products, especially farm products, are not for sale. You know, there's just... they're closed. The market is closed to American products.
So it's not actually tariffs that the EU is levying on US imports. It's actually that the EU doesn't want to buy, for example, US beef because of hormonal issues, or US chicken because it's chlorinated. So it's what Donald Trump is really saying here, that the EU has to start buying chlorinated chicken despite the EU's concerns around health and safety.
I love the chlorinated chicken example, because you'd have to eat 3 chlorinated chickens a day for 50 years to have any effects. And also, Europeans are already eating chlorinated blueberries, chlorinated salad. So there's some things that are sort of, you know, at the margin, a little bit sort of maybe too much detail for this conversation.
What's important, though, Greg, is that the detail really is important, because it strikes me what Donald Trump is saying here is that he wants the EU to set aside health and safety regulations so that we start buying products from the US that we're not comfortable with buying.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think he's forcing anyone to buy them, but opening the market is what's important. And look, I know that's a good example, and that's relevant. I'm not disputing that. But what I'm saying is, it's not just the tariffs. I mean, the EU had 10% tariffs on U.S. automobiles, and the U.S. had 2.5% on EU automobiles. So, you know, that's just not
Well, that's one example, but I think the flip side on trucks, for example, is that the U.S. has a higher tariff on trucks coming in from the EU.
So, I mean, it's the big problem with all of this, that you actually haven't delved down into any of this detail.
When I say you, I mean the U.S.
Yeah, but I think it's fair to say that the U.S. has a massive trade deficit with the EU and with China and many other countries. Now, it might be because U.S. consumers are richer. It might be because they like to buy cool things from our trading partners that we can't make in the U.S. That's part of it. But I think the tariffs and other non-tariff trade barriers are part of the reason there's massive trade deficits. But more importantly, perhaps, whatever the reasons are, we can't afford to fund it anymore. We just can't. $36 trillion.
You might be able to afford to fund it even less after the decisions that Donald Trump has made. The stock market down 1,128 points after 30 minutes when it opened today.
The response of the stock market to the tariffs announcement also arose when Áine Lawler spoke to Taoiseach Micheál Martin on Friday.
Well, the stock markets, if the Donald Trump and the bond markets, if you won't listen to world leaders who are universally condemning these moves on tariffs, will the stock market soften his cough and force them to compromise?
I think the markets will, and particularly in American currency, in terms of pensions and so on, and people will see
bond markets in particular.
See real issues for them. If that sustains, that will be problematic for the US administration. But already there's talk of deals and negotiations with individual countries. The big issue will be that there is a worrying antipathy towards the EU as an institution in the White House. And that is
a
big concern for us. Maros Sefcovic has had a series of meetings with Secretary of State Lutnick. But I think that is problematic, to be honest, in terms of our capacity to get a deal at EU level with the US. But all of the feedback to now has been, don't over-retaliate. There will be a negotiation process here. We'll see.
On the other hand, appeasement doesn't work with a bully.
Well, again, I think you have to, as I say, measured, phased response. We have weapons, Europe has, but let's be under no illusion. Once you deploy them, you are in a fully-fledged trade war, and people lose out in a fully-fledged trade war. That is a very unsatisfactory and uncertain position we are in. We believe this decision by President Trump is fundamentally wrong. Bad for people, bad for businesses, and bad for society.
One group who seem likely to be badly affected by the tariffs are farmers. On Friday's Morning Ireland, Charlie McKinley brought us this report from a sheep mart in Coothill in Cavan.
It's going to be a severe increase in the prices of meal, in the prices of feeding and raising cattle and sheep, and it's going to be very drastic, and all of our families over here now are already struggling with the prices of beef and the prices of sheep. And now it's just going to go through the roof. So it is. It's going to leave us all struggling for getting a few pounds out of a lot of days' hours' work. So it is.
I think it'll be an awful thing. We came through Brexit there and it was a serious thing. And now this here looks to be going to be something as bad or maybe worse. I don't think it's any worse than Brexit, but it's not good. It's not good for the country.
I won't be worried. I'd be worried about the milk and butter and all that stuff. If that rises by such a percentage, it's going to destroy us here, which it looks like it is, you know. And we are going to be hit harder than the north of Ireland.
Well, it's not good. It's not good for Ireland. It's not good for our economy, anything. That I think it's going to have a knock-on effect on all of us. And we're bad enough as it is, but it's going to make it worse. And the price of everything has just gone through the roof. It's not just now, but in the last 2-3 years, with the war in Ukraine and everything, the price of meal had gone up to near €12 a bag for sheep. Thankfully, it's come down a bit, but you go to do anything, and the price of animals have gone up, but when you go to buy something that you need for the farm, it's gone up too, so your animals has to go up to cover the cost.
After China's announcement on Friday that it was imposing an extra levy of 34% on all US goods, UK-based financial analyst Danny Hewson gave her reaction to the move to Rachel English on the News at One.
It is pretty significant because it is the first country to come out and say that the Liberation Day tariffs that Donald Trump announced on Wednesday, that it is not going to take. We know the European Union has already said it intends to retaliate. Canada is certainly making an awful lot of noise. Other countries like Australia and the UK still taking a step back, although drawing up lists of potential areas to put tariffs onto. But the fact that China has done it really sort of fires the starting gun, if you like, to what many people now think is an inescapable global trade war. I mean, you say, yes, that the US imports far more goods from China than it exports, but those goods that it exports are really important. You're talking about pharmaceuticals, crude oil, and agriculture, things like soya bean, wheat, and corn. When you think about Middle America and where their money comes from, this is going to hit those people very hard indeed, and a lot of them will have been Trump voters.
And for the last word on the subject of tariffs, on a slightly lighter note, this is how Colm O'Mungon opened the late debate on Thursday night.
Because of the aforementioned tariffs, a name we'll be hearing a lot over the next while is Maroš Šefčovič. Šefčovič, the EU trade commissioner. I say a name, but you'll frequently hear several different versions of it. Šefčovič, or more rarely, Šefčovič. Now, for a country that hates to hear Gallagher and Moran from football pundits across the water, I'm sure, Seamus, you're not a fan of McGrath either. Maybe it might be an idea to get the name of the man who'll be taking a lead role in negotiations right, just in case the Slovaks have the same hang-ups and sensitivities as ourselves when it comes to pronunciations. We don't appreciate it when people blank a father or when Americans say Donegal. Maroš Šefčovič, he has helpfully popped a circumflex above the letters S and C, which function like a H for English speakers. And if you think it's hard, spare a thought for the Slovaks themselves, who have 46 letters in their alphabet. It's the longest in the Slavic alphabets because of various renderings of letters with diacritics, those little symbols on the letters. Now, we only have to get our head around two of them, the S and the C. And a helpful way maybe of getting your tongue around it is to think of Sean Connery after a few jars and give it a go. Maroš Šefčovič. And after all the effort he put in for Brexit, which did so much good for our bond spreads, maybe a bad bond impression is the least we can do for Maroš Šefčovič.
Current affairs presenter and Sean Connery impersonator Colm O'Mungon has heard on Thursday's late debate.
Right now it's Kerry attacking again. And it's McGuire was it now, shaking off Kerry Cairns, getting inside his shot. Aldi's running to the ball and it's over the bar.
The amazing McGuire.
Kerry's chief scorer today, Mick O'Dwyer. He's got the ball, he shoots, and for a goal!
I've done everything I wanted to do. I did it all and got great enjoyment out of it, and I wouldn't change it for the world.
And there goes the final whistle, and Kerry have done it. Kerry have won 4 All-Irelands in a row, and they truly are the kingdom of football.
When the news came through on Wednesday's Morning Ireland that the legendary Kerry footballer and manager Mick O'Dwyer had died, Pádraig Lodge spoke to Des Cahill about his memories of Micko.
Well, funny, I just find it strange hearing the voice of older Micko there in the obituary, because
To me, the image in my head was Mika was such a fine, handsome, strong man. The black hair. The image in my head is him, the hands on the hips, in the middle of an All-Ireland, looking out on the pitch. And when I went to work for the Kerryman as a young dub, not many dubs went there, he was hugely suspicious what the hell I was doing working for the Kerryman. And he was cautious with me. But once he got to know me, he was so good to me for the rest of my career, going right through my days in RTE. He was very loyal from that point of view, and loyalty was a big thing with him. In fact, when they won the 4 in a row and didn't win the 5 in a row, some people said, was he too loyal to the fellas who had done it for him? Should he have brought younger players through? But he was always, as my weight fluctuated up and down in my RTE years, every time he'd see me, if I'd put on weight, he'd say, God, you're getting stronger. Or then if I'd lost, he'd say, you're not as strong as you were the last time, in fairness to you. He always called it my strength. But his success and the style of football the team played made him that legendary figure, as you said. You just say Mikko to anybody and everyone knows who you're talking about. And the sense of fun he had and the sense of roguery as well, because he brought Kerry on fantastic trips. They did a world tour in 1981, I remember. And his fundraising, he famously, very famously, did an ad for a washing machine, a Bendix washing machine, that became known as the Bendix scandal. And it was the lead story on the radio news and the newspapers. They posed for a full page ad, three or four of the players sitting on a washing machine with dirty gear on, and it was deemed this great scandal that the amateurs were doing this, but the money was going towards the Kerry squad holiday, so he was always working an angle like that. And then, of course, when he left Kerry, I mean, look at the joy Kildare people and Laois people and Wicklow people got from his role with him. He brought them success that they hadn't been used to. I think he made players feel taller when he went into those counties and told them, why won't we win this? And they believed him. And he was quite an extraordinary man and one of the most fantastic people I've come across in my career in sport, Borik.
And later in the day, GAA President Charlotte Byrne spoke to Rachel on the News at One about how Mick O'Dwyer fundamentally changed the role of manager.
I think what his legacy will be, he redefined or he created a new image of what it was like to become a GAA manager. Up until then, teams would have been selected by committee, by selectors, but he and Kevin Heffernan took these teams on themselves, and it was their rivalry really that defined that narrative of the 70s. And then obviously moving into the 80s, going for the 5 in a row, Kevin Heffernan retired and it became Eugene McKenna versus Mick O'Dwyer. And that became such a part of that whole era, the Mikko era. And I know for us up in the north, he was a celebrity banishteur. And when we went down to the south, down to Kerry, you always wanted to see, could you meet him or could you see him? We always went to Waterville to see if we could catch a glimpse of him. So it is a very, very sad day, and it's certainly the end of an era, Rachel.
As you say, he was integral to that great rivalry between Kerry and Dublin, which lit up the GAA for a long number of years and maybe brought the sport to a wider audience.
There's no doubt about that. And if you look in particular that 1978 All-Ireland final, and gradually those teams and those great characters are all Tashu de Gullar Fad, Arthina Fearing and Aleha Shaw. And we said our final farewell to Paddy Cullen, who was such a very important part of that era a few weeks ago in Dublin. If you remember that famous Mikey Sheehy goal. The one thing that Mick O'Dwyer always said was he would train a team, he would get them ready, but once they went out on the field, he would allow themselves to express themselves in the way that they felt they would do best. And I think that was the one thing about his creativity as a manager. He was a great motivator. He was somebody who really could create momentum with a team, regardless of who it was. But once the team went out, he allowed them to take responsibility. And that's really epitomised in that decision at that moment taken by Mikey Sheehy to chip Paddy Cullen in the 1978 All-Ireland final. And I feel on that day, everything changed in Gaelic football, because people were seeing Gaelic football then through the same lens almost of sexiness as they were soccer across the water. And a lot of young people began to choose GAA over soccer, basically as a result of that team and what they brought.
And one of the members of that iconic team, Jack O'Shea, was a guest this week on the championship presented by Damien Lawler.
I came onto the Kerry team as an 18-year-old. Mika was the manager and trainer of the team and that. And you looked up to him. He was like a god. He was like a god in Kerry at that time. Without a doubt, himself and Kevin Heffernan changed the whole face of football back in the 70s and the 80s, you know.
As a man then, Jacko, like, what was he like? Because from our dealings with him, like, you could have great, great crack with him. He always had a bit of fun. Was he like that as a manager, Jack? Could you have the crack or, as long as the work was being done as well? Or was he very much military precision on the field?
No, he was a rogue. he was a rogue. But he knew how to get to everybody. And I think Damien, his big asset was he was a great man manager. He could create a spirit in a team, you know, atmosphere in training, competitiveness in training. He had all that. He could do all that. And so sometimes, like, Mikko wouldn't come directly to yourself to say something to you. He could get one of your teammates to say something to you if he wanted to get a message across without being hurting you. Like, so he had ways of dealing with everything.
Wow.
But I suppose his philosophy was, you know, run the shite out of everybody, get everybody as fit as you can, you know. And that was his attitude. And but, like, he has, you know, he had great players. But when you have good players, you know, you need somebody there to manage them. And he had that ability that he could... You know, you were in or you were out at Mikko. You know, there was no kind of in between. I mean, we never really had tactics. We never had a tactic board. We had nothing like that. We just had a very simple way of playing, play the game at speed, move the ball fast. His message was always that nobody can run faster than the ball. And that was the message we had. And that's what we employed in our game. Like, we'd let the ball do the work, let the ball travel, hit the space, and let the lads work to get to the space. And he got the fellas so fit that they were able to run into that space in time and be there first to the ball.
Jack O'Shea and Tom Spillane also chatted to Cormac on Drive Time. The focus there was more on the yarns than the football.
I was talking to my brother Mick this morning after the news was announced, and Jack will confirm it as well. Between myself and my brother Mick and Pat, we have 19 All-Ireland medals as a family, okay? Mick O'Dwyer was instrumental in every one of them. In the same as Jack's 7 medals, he was involved with every one of them. Paddy Shea, the late Paddy Shea, Tim Kennedy, all there. He was involved with all those medals down through the years. So he had something special, and he kept us special. He kept us ticking over.
Oh, yeah.
And whether it was the trip to the World Trip, which we went in 1981, which was the incentive in the 4 in a row, the 5 in a row, which unfortunately came unstuck. We were going to go to Bali, but unfortunately...
And your brother Pat said the only Bali he got was Bali Bunyan.
Bali. he might have added to that, you know.
Yeah. But, good one, Cormac. We went to training one night in Tralee. We went in the car to Tralee one night training. And we came home with a hearse and a coffin in the back of it. Anything could happen when you were with me. Yeah.
Somebody's said that to us as well. For a short time, he also had an undertaker's business.
He was also a car salesman because on his way down from games, let's say up in Castlebar, we'd stop for the steak in the Queen's Hotel in Innes, and he'd have bought a car off Bob Lyne up there to bring down, and myself and my brother Mick would drive the car down, and he'd have the car sold to be picked up in Killarney. Oh, so geez. He was an entrepreneur in every sense of the word.
On Tuesday's Live Line, there was also lots of chat about travel, more specifically train travel, and the behaviour and misbehaviour of people on trains. Kay rang in with a good story about how herself and her daughter once got into serious trouble for putting their feet on a seat on a train in Australia.
We were in Melbourne there a few years ago with my daughter, and we just arrived and we were staying in the outskirts, a place called Ferntree Gully. And we said we'd go into the city that's the following day.
Right.
And we just got on the train and we put our, just literally just kind of put our foot slightly on the seat, the two of us. And before we knew
it... And in fairness, Kay, were you tired?
Jaded. We were jet lagged.
Oh, you were jet lagged, of course.
Yeah, because we had just arrived, you see. And
so you were jet lagged. You were jet lagged on the train.
Yeah, jet-lagged on the train, yes. Exhausted, yes. Hanging.
Hanging, yes.
We'd no drink on it.
I know.
And the next thing before we knew it, oh my God, these two fellas came down. They were undercover train police.
Wow.
They had guns. Oh, Jesus, I got it. I nearly lost my life. They threatened to take us off the train. I thought it was a joke. I actually said, is this a joke? I couldn't believe it.
Is this candle
camera?
Oh,
my God. We nearly came home. I was so upset. Jesus. We got off at the next stop. We didn't know where we were. We got such a fright. But
Kay,
I'm saying, you know now in Australia.
About being sent home. But, Kay, they were undercover, plain clothes. How do you know they had guns?
Well, their jacket, they're kind of
bulging. Okay, you can see the gun. Okay, wow.
I knew they meant business. I knew they meant business. Oh my God, my daughter. Oh Jesus, I was nearly going to come home the following day. It's true as I'm here. I got such a fright. They gave us an awful doom. They were going to throw us off. They were going to fine us. They took out their books. everything. Oh my God.
And Kay, did you?
I haven't been back since. I threw the Irish card as well, but they didn't take it. Okay. You know, I just said we're from Ireland, and you know, we didn't realise it was such. You know, that it was so strict here and everything. You know, God Almighty. I just said to my daughter Alison, "Where's the nearest Irish pub?" I said, "I need a drink after this."
A few programmes this week picked up on sightings of the hoopoe bird. The first I heard of it was on the Ray Darcy Show on Thursday when Jim Wilson, Birdwatch Ireland volunteer and author, told Ray all about it.
If you gave a five-year-old pen, paper, black and white crayons and a bit of orange and they came up with that, you'd say, lovely, but...
Yeah, doesn't exist.
Know, in your imagination.
Yeah, absolutely. You've noticed we're on radio, Jim. So will you do your best to describe it to our listeners,
please?
I will surely.
It's slightly bigger than a blackbird. It's, let's say, the most striking feature of it when it's on the ground is it's kind of a pale orange and black and white, but it's got this mohawk, this ridiculous mohawk that it raises on its head, which is orange with black tips on it. And then when it flies, it always reminds me of a mini flying zebra or something like that, because all you see is black and white stripes when the wings open up, and they're big round wings, very big round wings, and they fly, some say almost like a butterfly. You know, they're not flapping all the time, so these wings flash out and in and out and in and out and in, unmistakable, and will catch anybody's eye. That you don't have to be a bird watcher or even into nature. You'll see this, you kind of go, that's after escaping from the zoo or somebody's, you know, cage.
And where was it spotted, this hoopoe?
The thing is, we get them every year. We get a few, so it's not unusual to hear that somebody has seen one. But what's unusual at the moment is we're seeing numbers like we've never ever seen before, concentrating all along the south coast, but also as far north as the Aran Islands and County Louth even. And I know in Britain they've had them up in Scotland, northern Scotland. Really unprecedented. And they normally breed, the nearest breeding areas is in France. And we reckon, we're not sure, but the unusual weather pattern of this very big high pressure sitting on top of us has meant that these hoopoes who spend the winter south of the Sahara, usually, or in southern Europe, northern Africa, when they come north to breed, a bit like the swallows, they overshoot, a bit like the brakes don't work.
Right.
And because the weather is looking fantastic, we think some of them just keep flying, and then they end up here. But of course, then the weather will change. We'll get a cold snap or something, and we reckon then most of them retreat back south. Yeah. It gets its name from the sound it makes. It's not unlike a cuckoo, which is how it got its name. It's onomatopoeic.
Ah, right.
So when you hear it, if you hear it here now.
I do it better, actually.
Hoopoo, 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 hoopoo. You hear that?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like a cuckoo on speed.
Ray Darcy having way too much fun imitating a hoopoe. Another man in high spirits on the airwaves this week was Donegal sheep farmer Peter McGee, who was bowled over recently when two of his yeos gave birth to sextuplets. He spoke to Maggie Doyle on Morning Ireland.
One was scanned for six and another was scanned for five. The first one they scanned for six, she lambed first, and then the second one lambed five, and I went out, I came in for a bottle for to feed the fifth one, and I went out to lift the lamb on the sixth one.
My goodness, and tell us about these wonderful two yeos you have. How are they doing?
Oh, they're doing fine now, so I took a lot out of them, you know. There's one, when she'd lie down, I used to have to lift her up, she's that heavy, you know.
I can imagine.
With the six lambs,
I can imagine. Tricky enough. How are the lambs doing? There's wonderful pictures on our website, rtnews.ie, of these beautiful lambs, and they look fantastic.
We spent nearly a week in the shed, night and day, feeding them. They were fed every 2 hours.
And I understand that you borrowed a ram from your cousin.
Yeah, I borrowed a ram from my cousin, and it was my cousin that done the scan, another man that done the scanning, and I want to thank him. For him, I wouldn't have known, you know, that it's not easy counting for six lambs, you know. When I put in the first yo, and says, is there a problem? He says, I'm trying to count here. And I couldn't believe it myself when he had six dots on her, you know. And
tell
five
us,
then on the next one. And it was just amazing, so it was.
And tell us, Peter, will you be borrowing the same ram again next year?
Well, I think I will. You know, he's a very special ram, so he is.
And are they still being bottle fed? Who's feeding them? With lovely pictures of your grandchildren with some of the bottles
for
the lambs.
There's three on each yoe, you know, and then I'm feeding six, so I am.
You're busy out. We know what it's like feeding newborns.
From Wednesday's Morning Ireland. Kay Sheehy was joined by two of Ireland's most celebrated writers in the Arena studio on Wednesday, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Paul Muldoon and Booker Prize-winning author Anne Enright, in advance of a joint public interview at UCD. Here, Anne tells Kay about what happened when she met Paul in an airport when she was in the middle of writing The Wren, The Wren, her book about a fictional poet.
I think I've told people before that I met Paul in an airport and I was in the middle of writing The Wren, The Wren. And some very childlike thing came over me, which I have to watch out for in the future, which was that I realised that I had as my fake poet, Phil McTara, who was already a bit of a fake, actually, in a funny way. I had written some poems for this novel. And then I realised that I had all the novel on my phone, which is a terrible thing to be carrying around with you the whole time, because I email it every day to my husband. So several times a day, every new draft. And so I thought I could just scroll through and find one of the poems and
chase him down.
I know, yeah. So it's the rudest thing I've done in a very long time.
It was a wonderful thing. I was thrilled to read them. Absolutely not. What can one imagine having a better time than meeting Anne Enright in an airport?
Bearing poetry. Yeah, I don't know.
And at the end of that interview, Paul read one of his poems.
Well, this is called By the Time You Read This. By the time you read this, I'll be gone for a newspaper and quart of milk, never to return. A half-mowed lawn leading to me as a scroll of silk once led to the mulberry silkworm. By the time you read this, I'll be gone AWOL. In spite of the fact, in terms of domesticity, I've outshone even the heedful trumpeter swan that spends 5 weeks constructing a nest. By the time you read this, I'll be gone less because of some profound unrest than my fascination with the Cree and the sandhills of Saskatchewan, into which windswept immensity. By the time you read this, I'll be long gone.
Staying with poets, the drama on one production last weekend was Eternal Lanes of Joy, written and directed by Pat Collins and produced by Kevin Brew. It recreated Patrick Kavanagh's epic journey on foot from his home in County Monaghan to Dublin in 1931.
Last year, one day in May, I was standing on the top of one of my little hills and I looked across at the sun-flecked plains of Louth and Meath and knew how fine a thing it was to be alive. The green fields and the simple homes told me of the unchanging beauty of Ireland. At my feet were primroses and violets, a magic carpet on which I could journey over the Baghdads of dreamland. In the hollow, a man was hoeing potatoes. Now and then he looked my way and I knew he was angry with me. He thought me a lazy good-for-nothing.
What the hell are you always dreaming about?
Aye. This man, one of my neighbours, was a realist. And realism untouched by the imagination is a sordid, petty thing. He made me feel that I was just a lazy fool. That all my dreams of beauty and love were only codology. By the heels, he pulled me down from the stars and made me a worm cutter.
A sup of rain would do no harm.
Who wants rain?
Should the cattler starve for a mouthful of grass? You're an awful man doesn't trim them hedges. You could plough in 3 yards further if them briars were cut. To hell with the briars.
Did a man like him ever notice butterflies? The man was wise in the ways of the world, but wasn't it easy being wise in that way? Curious how I started off with the right simplicity, indifferent to crude reason, and then ploughed my way through complexities and anger, hatred and ill will towards the faults of man, and came back to where I started. For one of the very earliest things I wrote started this way. Child, do not go into the dark places of soul, for there the grey wolves whine, the lean grey wolves. In that little thing, I had become airborne and more. For you are driving your horses through the mist where Genesis begins.
From Eternal Lanes of Joy by Pat Collins, Patrick Kavanagh was played by Michael Murphy, and that production is available to listen back to on the RTÉ website or wherever you get your podcasts. On Thursday's Drive Time, Cormac and Sarah interviewed Dr. Ben Beaumont from Trinity College London, who has completed a study into what are referred to as the politisms people use in their daily interactions.
We picked out things like, could I just squeeze past you, for example, or sounds fun, I'll let you know. When we mean kind of thing like, actually, please just get out of my way, or, you know, I'll let you know, probably means I'm not coming. So what we're doing here is wrapping up our actual meaning, wrapped in politeness, because so often we don't want to offend someone, but we do want to get that pragmatic meaning, that actual meaning of our communication across, and we use politisms to do that.
Can I throw you some on your list that I hear all the time, right?
Yeah, so I'm looking at the list, I'm just saying, go on.
In the Dáil Éireann, our parliament, you hear very often, with all due respect,
that's the one that's
deputy, with
too.
All due respect, you tell us what that means.
Well, that's basically just saying I'm right and you're not so right. So I think what is really important here when it comes to actually looking at the underlying meaning is the cultural relevance and also the context, the underlying subtext, because sometimes, with all due respect, can be used actually quite earnestly. Mm. But in many cases, like as you say, maybe in political spheres, it often means, well, actually, I hear what you're saying, but I disagree entirely. Okay. So that context and that subtext is really important in helping us understand actually what the communicative meaning is.
So something my colleagues say to me very often at the editorial meeting when we're discussing ideas for the programme, I throw the idea out and they say, interesting idea. Can you tell me what that politism means, Ben?
Well, you know, I think I'm going to have to be polite in my reply here. I'm sure they're saying that your response is really good and really worth investigating further. Maybe I'll just leave it at that.
No, I'll tell you what you have on your list. That means that's a terrible idea, Sarah. Yeah. That's what they're saying.
Or our producer is suggesting it means maybe not for today.
Exactly. It's a good idea, but maybe one that will be looked at maybe a little bit later. But I think what we see here is that politeness. I mean, because if your colleagues were to say, no, actually, that's rubbish, some people do react quite badly, unsurprisingly. So
I wouldn't.
It's a nice way of, it's being very kind, I think.
Yeah, he just brings it up on radio as a way of getting back.
And before he finished up the interview, Cormac had another contribution to make.
We'll finish on a very Irish politism. Look, Ben, we'll let you go. We'll let you go. That's how we finish conversations here. It means I have to go, really. But Dr. Ben Beaumont, Head of English Language Teacher Strategy and Publishing at Trinity College London, thank you very much.
And I too have to let you go, since that brings us to the end of this week's programme. Bradley Marshall was a guest on The Ray Darcy Show on Thursday. He's a young singer from Dublin who's attracting a lot of attention recently, and when you hear his voice, you'll understand why. This is one of the two songs he sang live for Ray. It's called Save My Heart. I'm Fiona Kelly. So until the next time, goodbye.